walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and today we're presenting a special edition of Talking Animals, by which I mean I've scrapped the usual format in order to present a discussion about sexism, sexual harassment, and misconduct in the animal welfare world by way of two extended interviews. The first, which we'll get to in a moment, will involve talking with Dr. Lisa Kemmerer, a philosopher, activist, author, and professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University, Billings. Later in the program, I'll speak with Carol J. Adams, the feminist activist and author, perhaps best known for her work, The Sexual Politics of Meat. More on Carol later. Right now, after mentioning that as time permits, we may include calls at 813-239-9663, emails at dj@wmnf.org, or text at 813-433-0885. I'd like to welcome Dr. Lisa Kemmerer back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Kemmerer.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals again.
Delighted to be here.
Great. So as you know, I had been wondering recently why, against this backdrop of growing national reporting and discussion about sexual misconduct in a number of fields, really showbiz, media, comedy, politics, and more, that there hasn't been any discussion really of this behavior within animal welfare, and was pondering a show to explore this and how best to do so. And then, boom, in the midst of my considering this, you emailed out of the blue saying, hey, are you interested in doing a show on this, noting the climate was right? So now I had wanted to go with convening a panel discussion. You had disabused me of that, in this case, poor idea. So here we are today speaking with you, and then later this morning with Carol Adams. So let me start with the original fundamental question. Why do you think these topics are not really discussed in the movement, especially now when across a wide array of fields and professions, people do seem to be discussing it?
All right, so it is being discussed. It's just that it's only in certain small circles, and there's a great deal of caution. And what's interesting is that actually our movement in many ways has been ahead of other social justice movements, and it's being talked about for 30-plus years, but with caution. And there's been, when it comes up, it's usually, well, one of the problems is the males involved have a lot of power. So when it comes up, there's a lawsuit, and who has the money?
Okay, so people do raise it and they do discuss it. And you say in this realm, it's been discussed prior to not only other social justice movements, but I mean, yeah, just generally, it seems like on all kinds of professions and fields, you can't turn on the radio, the TV, pick up a newspaper, get online, do anything without hearing of yet another set of revelations. So you're saying that's been going on, but just below at least the general radar. And then when it does pop up, it's quashed by lawsuits.
Well, there's a specific problem inside social justice movement, and it's one of loyalty and inside-facing loyalty. So, and we've all heard it, right? Nobody suffers more than the animals, right? Don't hurt the movement. Your loyalty has to be to the animals. And this is one of the myths of the movement that kind of ignores what most people call intersectionality and what I generally refer to as overlapping oppressions. So you can't solve one problem without solving the other problem, right? So there's a system of oppressions, and animal exploitation is part of that, but sexism is also part of that, and male privilege is also part of that. So you can't solve one without solving the other. But in the movement, there's a sense that if you point the finger at one of these big men, then you're hurting the movement, and you're embarrassing the movement publicly. But when something's wrong, it's wrong, and you have to point it out. And at the end of the day, we're not going to save the animals unless we get some equality going, some general social justice among ourselves. It's all connected.
And so I guess from what you're saying so far, it's just been enough with the occasional lawsuit to punctuate it. But I guess it's generally just been enough to say, hey, if you speak up, if you come forward, if you make that kind of accusation, it'll hurt the movement. It'll ultimately hurt the animals. So yeah, that's been enough to just say, okay, I guess I'll just sort of stay quiet.
For most women in the movement, And remember, the movement is 75%, about 75% women and about 25% men. And that has been enough to keep many of them quiet because they're disempowered. Women form, you know, the structure of the movement. They are the ones doing all the work, but many men hold a whole lot of power, right? If you look out there at the structure of the movement, take the two biggest movements, like PETA's, woman run, but that's very rare. Look at HSUS, a bunch of men at the top. So when you have a bunch of men at the top, you're much more likely to have a problem with sexism. And the men at the top have tons of money behind them, tons of prestige, tons of power. And even if a woman accuses them, even the women in the movement will jump forward to protect the organization, because their loyalty is to the movement and the organization, not to some woman that they don't know, who almost surely is not lying when she comes forward. Who does that? Extremely rare. But they're trying to protect the big men who they see as saviors of the animals. And I think there's one other thing that really hurts women in bringing justice and clamping down on sexism and male privilege, and that's the sense that men in the movement are compassionate. Why else, you know, they're bunny hugging, you know, they'll rescue the stray kitty. If that's who they are, how could they possibly be exploiting women? So both the ignorance and their sense of looking at these men as kind of heroes of the movement and seeing them as someone who wouldn't do that, and then the rest of the pressure of the movement of kind of forcing them not to do that, both through jumping to the sides of the men and also the lawsuits that will follow, and of course the women who are being sexually assaulted or in some other way harassed don't have any money. They don't have the resources or the power.
And I just want to go back for a sec, because when you noted that 75%, it's 75% women in this movement. I mean, in the preliminary stages of sorting out how to present this this morning's show, and before I'd done my homework and conducted some research, I mentioned to you that I wondered if the decided preponderance of women in animal rights, welfare, rescue, whatever one wants to call it, worked as a hedge against the sexism and sexual misconduct we're seeing emerge in so many other fields. And you were really nice in explaining the reality of things. I mean, like, one would speak to a young child with special needs, but basically like, oh my God, okay. But the thing is, I don't mind exposing myself as a dope in this, because I do think that's probably maybe not an uncommon position. And even when I was thinking about the show before you and I got in touch, or actually maybe after, I communicated with really smart, cool journalist that covers a lot of animal stuff. And I think she had basically the same, you know, guess or idea. So yeah. So I guess, is that also part of what works against this, is that people like me, and I'm sure I'm not the only person that had that kind of thing so wrong, that also works against people coming forward? Because, again, the ultimate thing that, beyond the ones you mentioned, that just generally seems to work against people coming forward is, hey, I won't be believed, I won't be taken seriously, not to mention the damage. So is that kind of what's also underneath this a bit?
Yes, general ignorance is absolutely the case. So unless you have been affected by it or know someone who's been affected by it, you have a tendency to believe everything's rosy in the movement. What's interesting, and I'm doing a survey right now on harassment and discrimination in the movement, you can find that under the testimonials section of a group called canhad.org, and that's a fantastic organization too, or it's not an organization, it's a website that helps people with harassment and discrimination in any nonprofit organization. So there's things up there that can help, but through this survey, I've really seen just how many women are affected. But they are isolated, and so there's no way for them to work together. They talk to each other, but they're so disempowered. And there's so much ignorance outside that circle that's been affected. And I would say the circle is large. I can't remember what the survey is showing, but there's a huge percentage of women in our movement that are affected. And most of them are affected. Well, I wouldn't say, I would say most are affected by leadership, people in positions of power. So when they are filling out the survey, they say who it is that has harassed or sexually assaulted them. Sexual assault is a type of harassment. They often point to CEOs, donors, just people of power, leaders, someone who is their boss. So if that's the person who's doing wrong, how exactly do you deal that, especially if you're a new employer, a 20-year-old as opposed to a 4-year-old? And they're also saying that the men tend to be a good bit older than they are. And then outside of those people being affected, there's just a bunch of people, especially the men, they're completely oblivious. They just have no idea.
And so the surveys that you're doing, when people do write in, I guess they're identifying specifically who that donor is, who that CEO is, who that other person typically in power is.
They can. I certainly, and I will never, I can't even tell who's filling it out. So there's no identifying features for me.
Right.
Well, so I have no idea, but one of them did blatantly say the name of the person, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, well, I would think under the cloak of, well, we'll talk about Ken Head in a sec more, but let me just, in case people are just tuning in, let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm discussing sexism, sexual harassment, and misconduct in the animal welfare world with Dr. Lisa Kammerer, a philosopher, activist, author, and professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University, Billings. Later in today's program, I'll also speak with Carol J. Adams, a feminist activist and author, perhaps best known for her book, The Sexual Politics of Meat. Not sure how many calls we'll have time to take, but you're invited to call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So yeah, let's talk just for another moment a little bit more about CANHAD, because that's among the elements that has sort of helped me travel a little bit of a learning curve on this matter in the last several days. Can you say a little bit more about the website and how one submits to it?
Yeah, the website is just good to know about because this is a problem, and you don't need to feel alone. And we do feel alone because what do you do when this is happening to you in a movement? There's a real sense of camaraderie and loyalty. So if you go to canhead.org, it helps you understand the problem better, and there's how you can find a lawyer, how you can get help, understanding what harassment is, what sexual assault is, how rape fits into that. So you just have a better sense of what's going on. And a lot of the problem isn't just ignorance of those who aren't affected, but those who are affected. They don't know the laws, and they don't know that this what's going on is against human rights and against many laws. So plugging them in to get that information and to know what to do is what CANHAD is all about. CANHAD.org, CANHAD.org.
And they're a key part of this. I mean, there's all those resources that Dr. Kammerer just mentioned, but something we alluded to already is there's also a section for testimonials, which people are invited to submit, obviously anonymously, and they within that don't identify usually the organization or obviously any figures in it that they're writing about. But I'm just going to, I mean, some of these that are directly tied to animal rights or animal welfare, there's actually the first one is quite long, but let me just read at least one of the others. So this one just says, I was standing in the barn of a nonprofit animal sanctuary, which I was visiting for research purposes, listening to a long-term high-up staff member talk about his 6 years of work at the sanctuary. He commented, quote, I used to date and had long-term relationships, but not anymore. I have an endless supply of volunteers coming through, and almost all of them are girls. I mean,
this is so common. It is so common in the movement. There's so many more females than males, and the females tend to be trusting of the men in the movement, and they also tend to be very gentle and sensitive, tender-hearted. That's why they're in the movement. So it's harder for them to say no. It's harder for them to be suspicious, to be on guard, or to deal with these perpetrators. So this kind of a problem is actually, it's embarrassingly big in our movement.
And I guess just a couple of things that are also in this testimonial and I've seen elsewhere is that this isn't clear that this is an animal organization, but it's just general enough that I still thought, well, because again, they talk about it's a nonprofit, so they're watching their costs and expenses and stuff. So this talks about I was interning for a large nonprofit in an effort to save the organization money when traveling. Employees and interns of different sexes were expected to share rooms and even beds.
Yes, again, common.
While traveling, a white male employee who was both older than I was and also my supervisor came on to me when we were traveling and sharing a room. We had sex, but I didn't feel I could say no, given his position of power in the organization. I mean, in a fairly short, like one or two or three sentences, there's a few things that are kind of hair-raising there.
Yes, the power dynamic. Again, it's a huge problem. But, you know, one of my recommendations for the movement is just don't hire men in leadership positions. Why would we? When with 75% females in the movement, why do we think we need males as leaders? Now, you can't help it when they found an organization and choose to run it themselves. But when anyone's hiring for a leadership position, choose women, and it avoids a lot of these problems.
We're jumping ahead, and that's good, because I was just wondering, like, having learned just how pervasive this is and how the thing that I, as a slightly previously dopey guy, that's exactly where the problem rests, really, is the preponderance of females, as a couple of these testimonials, or at least one in particular, kind of suggest. So, yeah, that I was wondering, first of all, what general solutions there are, and what, in the meantime, can be done along the lines of CANHAD and maybe your survey, et cetera, to make it safer for people to come forward.
Yes, and that would be one of my main suggestions for changing it, is believe women when they step forward. stand by them. It would just be so just so unusual for a woman to go through the embarrassment and the shame and all that's involved in pointing the finger in outing someone. So it's almost always true. So stand by them, support them, listen to them, and do what they say. If they don't want anyone else to know, just listen. Point them to a place like canhad.org where they can learn more about what the problem is, what it means, definitions, where to go. Be a support.
Yeah, I mean, so there's so many things that are so hard to kind of like wrap your head around. Like, I mean, how do we reconcile that people employed in animal welfare and advocacy are, of course, generally striving to work on behalf of animals, the underprivileged, the underdogs, mm-hmm. if you will, yes. the disenfranchised. Yet as we're learning and talking about now, or some of us are learning, some of us already knew, women in this field are often treated really poorly, like property, which of course is the ongoing debate in legislation and legal levels, or worse.
Yes. We have to remember that we live in a sexist culture. And I think understanding that is key. Learning about systemic oppression. Learning about male privilege. All the men in the movement need to read up on sexism and male privilege. And the women do, too, so that they see it coming. And also, there's as I say, you know, Carol Adams' book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, it's been out there a long time. And my books, Sister Species and Speaking Up for Animals, also both cover that connection between sexism and speciesism. There are materials out there. Get a hold of them and read them. Start understanding the connections between sexism and speciesism so that we're committed as activists to the fact that we have to fight both and that we know what they are and we know what the links are.
And can you talk, you touched on this a second, but can you talk a bit more about your view of why sexism and male privilege are so much of a problem in the animal welfare realm?
Well, racism is too, right? It's the fact that our larger culture has them. So when we talk about oppressions, there are things that sit quietly in our culture and we are unaware of them. So as long as we're ignorant of them, until I started learning about it, the racism in our culture, the fact that I'm a person of privilege and how that shows up in my life, starting to see it and learn about it, the painfulness of that. So we have to be willing to face it and we have to educate ourselves. So with sexism and male privilege, it's like the air we breathe. We're so used to it, we don't think about it and we don't notice it. If somebody asked me about my environment, I wouldn't talk about the air that I'm breathing. I'd talk about what's sitting on my desk. Not because what's sitting on the desk is more important than what air that I'm breathing, but that it's just something I don't notice. And male privilege, sexism, racism, those are like that. They're things we don't notice, but they're central to how we live.
Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm discussing sexism, sexual harassment, misconduct, and other issues in the animal welfare with Dr. Lisa Kemmerer, a philosopher, activist, author, and professor of philosophy and religions at Montana State University, Billings. Later in today's program, I'll speak with Carol J. Adams, the feminist activist and author, best known perhaps for her work, The Sexual Politics of Meat. So I'm not sure how many calls we'll have time to take here, but again, you are invited to call 813-239-9663, email DJ at WMNF.org, text 813-433-0885. So as we talk,
I want to say something about male privilege in the movement. It's just by way of grounding a term that otherwise may not mean anything. So I'm a professor, and in the classroom, I can see male privilege all the time. Males feel more confident, they feel more capable, they speak up faster, they speak up with more confidence, and you can see when they speak that they feel like they know something as opposed to the women in the class. And this is a generalization, but generalizations are generally true. Now, in the movement, you see the same thing. You see men as leaders. You see them in leadership positions. You see them, whatever they're doing is believed to be bigger, better, more important than what women are doing. So, for example, if you take direct action, it has this big name. Direct action can't even happen without all the things that women are doing in the movement. And this is typical of our society. We aggrandize and make big and important everything that men do, right? It's the big hunting culture thing, right? Gathering isn't important. It's a hunting that's a big deal. Yeah, right. Gathering was 98% of what people ate. Hunting was no big deal. It was probably a way, I don't know, for either men to get away from women and not have to do the work, or for women to get rid of the men, or who knows what. But the point is that hunting certainly was not as important as it's come down in the culture to be and as myths make it out to be. And our culture is no different. And so in the movement, we see how the things that men do, how it's militarized, the actions are militarized, right? So military is male, it's aggressive, it has to do with testosterone. So you can see how men are leaders and what they do is seen as more important, and how many times, and women will say this, in groups. If there's somebody that needs tea or coffee, or if there's cleaning up after the meeting's over, the men just kind of sit there and expect the women to do it. And the women often do it. But they're not there to clean up after the men or to serve them. They are in the movement and they're activists for the animals on the same basis. And everything that women do in this movement, it's the lifeblood of the movement. And we need to recognize that to see it any other way and to see, I mean, if you look at the big heroes of the movement, they should all be women. And if you look at someone like Ingrid Newkirk, and if you look at PETA, and I have talked to people within PETA, there is no problem with sexual harassment or any of these types of things in PETA. And it's because it's a woman-run organization, and she has women at the top. I was looking on their website, all but one in the top, they're all women. So again, that's one of the ways to solve this problem, is to not have men in power positions, at least until we sort out the problem of male privilege. But anyway, why would you in a movement that's 75% female run?
Yeah, well, it's a lot of interesting things there, including I think that there's a growing sense of huge dissatisfaction with PETA, so and the work that they do these days. So
and they're called sexist, and it's why I love to bring that up, right?
Yeah, well,
so, yeah, there's some sexism in there, but when it comes to me, the stuff that really matters, which is how the women are treated in the group, they're safe there.
Yeah, okay. Because one of the things, as you talk more about just men are viewed that way, and so the actions are militarized, and I'm wondering what sort of indications have you seen that men with maybe sort of perpetrator tendencies even are drawn to this field precisely because preponderance of women here and opportunity, I guess.
Right. Yeah, well, you read that testimonial, right? The guy at the sanctuary.
Yeah.
Men figure it out pretty quick when they show up at a group, and you know, let's say they have a girlfriend who's into it, and she brings them to, and they recognize there's all women here. This is looking pretty good, and of course they're treated really well when they show up because I don't know why they're treated. In some senses, they're treated better. Oh boy, a man's joining. Well, I know why it is. Again, it has to do with that male privilege. It has to do with the sense that we need men in the movement to make it legitimate. And if you look back through history, this is a really interesting thing, that at some point they actually specifically used a strategy of getting men to be the spokespersons because they recognized that men were viewed as rational and scientific. And rather than talking about compassion and suffering, they needed men and men's voices to make it legitimate what the people in the movement were saying, and it was pretty much all women at that time. So it was a strategy. So for that same reason, and again, that's that cultural bias that we're not even aware of, that when it's a group of almost all women and a man shows up, there's just like, oh boy, legitimacy, strength, power, you know, somebody that can make our movement look like something other than just a bunch of females getting together who really aren't going to have any relevancy in our culture.
Wow.
Sickening, isn't it?
Well, yeah, again, it's a lot to take in, and sadly, we only have maybe a minute or so left, Dr. Kemmer, but let me ask you this, because so much of this, in this realm in particular, kind of sits in darkness, and one of the things that has really helped bring things to light in other fields has made me wonder, like, if the Washington Post or the New York Times did an investigation of one or more problematic figures in the animal welfare movement, akin to recent major reports that have made a big difference, I think, in some of those other worlds, would that turn the tide?
It would certainly help, and toppling some of these trouble causers is important. And in looking for trouble, just look for big men in the movement running organizations, and you're probably looking at them. And my recommendation is, again, be sensitive to those who are complaining. Don't think you're protecting the movement by protecting these big men. You're not. You're hurting it.
Okay. Well, I think we unfortunately have reached the end of our time.
Can I say, please, go to lisakemmerer.com. You can probably find the introduction to Sister Species, hopefully also to Speaking Up for Animals. Those are two anthologies with lots of women's voices talking about these various connections in the movement. You can also get a hold of me at lkemmerer@msubillings.edu. You can find that on at lisakemmerer.com. Happy to be in touch with you. Also, please go to canhead.org and take the survey. Thank you. And Duncan, it's always terrific talking with you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I was going to mention the website, which again, it's Lisa and then K-E-M-M-E-R-E-R.com for all those things. And CANHAD is simply, it's like an acronym, so it's C-A-N-H-A-D.org. So, Dr. Kemmer, thank you again for your time, your information, your insights. And right now we're hearing a band called Consolidated that recorded a song saluting Carol Adams' landmark work, The Sexual Politics of Meat, including spoken passages from the book. We'll be back in a moment with Carol Adams herself here on Talking Animals on WMNF.
as mirror and representation of patriarchal values. Meat eating is the reinscription of male power at every meal. The patriarchal gaze sees not the fragmented flesh of dead animals, but appetizing food. Vegetarian activities counter patriarchal consumption and challenge the consumption of death. Feminist vegetarian activity declares that an alternative worldview exists, one which celebrates life rather than consuming death, one which does not rely on resurrected animals, but empowered people.
This has been Consolidated with their song entitled, not coincidentally, The Sexual Politics of Meat, the title of the groundbreaking book written by our next guest, Carol J. Adams. As I mentioned earlier in the show, Carol is a feminist, vegan, advocate, activist, independent scholar, and author of numerous books, including the aforementioned landmark work, The Sexual Politics of Meat. She's also the co-editor of several anthologies, including Ecofeminism, Feminist Intersections with Other Animals and the Earth, and recently wrote an article entitled The Second Class Status, an Exploitation of Women in the Animal Rights Movement. Yesterday, she put up two blog posts that deal directly with this morning's topic that can be found on her website, caroljadams.com. So let's speak with Carol. While noting that we'll forego calls at this point, but we'll consider incorporating emails at dj@wmnf.org or text at 813-433-0885 into this conversation, I'd like to welcome Carol J. Adams to Talking Animals. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
I'm very well, and I appreciate you joining me today on Talking Animals.
Thanks for devoting this hour to this important conversation about sexual harassment and exploitation in the animal rights movement.
Sure. Well, initially, at least, I'd like to focus my attention on your August paper that I just alluded to, entitled The Second Class Status and Exploitation of Women in the Animal Rights Movement. In the introduction of that paper, you mentioned the long history of women who've confided in you about experiences of sexual exploitation. Quote, that for almost 30 years, I have received numerous personal reports from victimized animal activist women. It turns out you've been listening to the first part of the conversation with Dr. Kemmer. So can you outline, against the backdrop of all these reports and people coming forward and these other fields, showbiz, media, comedy, politics, and so on, can you outline the history of the problem in the movement? And again, maybe to underscore some of what Dr. Kemmer and I spoke about, why people here are not coming forward?
Well, I think Lisa's sort of touched on some of the issues which have to do with the disproportionate number of women, the assumption that women have that men in the movement are kind and sympathetic and empathetic and just the kind of person that you can trust. In the one of the blogs I posted yesterday, I call it the vulnerability of inequality, that the sexual inequality that exists in the larger culture is reproduced in our movement. And we think the movement is something separate from the dominant culture because the movement gets it about animals, wants to stop the property status of animals, wants to stop the consumption. So we think that somehow the animal rights movement is this zone that isn't reproducing inequality. But, of course, it's riven with inequality. And actually, the outside culture helps to reinforce that. In the early 90s, I'd hear stories about how the media would approach whatever man was present and ask them for comments when the head of the organization was a woman, or other instances of that, so that there was this tendency to, either from inside or outside, to elevate the men. I think there's also this question of how we experience boundaries. So if we're really caring and we're encouraged in the animal rights movement to do everything for the animals, and, you know, you can't take a nap, you've got to be out picketing, or you can't take a nap, you've got to follow up on this, that we lower our valuing of self-care. And we encourage people to be self-sacrificial, so that we're sort of saying to women especially, no, don't have boundaries. But then you get these men who are really over-boundaried. You know, there's always that talk about men on the subway, or, you know, how they'll sit with their legs open and take up much more space. well, that's a sort of over-boundary person, but an over-boundary person in any movement, it's like the comedians and everyone else. They think they can touch. They think they can create relationships, sexualized relationships with whoever they're interacting with in the animal rights movement. And I also think that some men actually engage in what I would call grooming behavior. It was used about child sexual exploiters and abusers, how they groom a child to accept more and more the erosion of their own boundaries. And I think there's a lot of grooming behavior, water cooler jokes that are sexist and sexual in nature, touching. You touched on the whole thing of, oh, to save money, we've got to all be in the same Airbnb. Which, without ever thinking about the vulnerability that this puts, especially young women activists at.
Yeah,
and so we've had the environment for it all along. We've reproduced the dominant culture, and where did the women who were affected? Where could they go with this? Well, they'd come to people like me because of my book, The Sexual Politics of Meat. They came to Marty Keel when she was alive. They came to some of the other feminist activists because they could trust us. Because when they tried to talk about it to the people they thought they could trust, they were told to keep it quiet. They were told not to discuss it. It would hurt the movement. And in fact, they were sometimes sued for reporting abuse.
Like defamation suits? Or
right.
Yeah. People have been coming to you about this for decades. So at some point, has it gotten better? Is it the same? Is it somehow gotten worse?
Well, I don't know that I can say better, worse. It's certainly not improved.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I can say it's gotten worse, because it could have really been worse in the 90s. I just wasn't approached by everybody who experienced it. Ever we would have meetings, would go to the national AR meetings, and we would try to always have a meeting with women. This always came up, how to handle it. And whenever I've traveled, if men who I know were sexual exploiters had recently been in that community, I would ask the women what happened, how'd that go, and then I'd hear an outpouring of stories or specific women's experience of sexual harassment. So I think the Me Too campaign is helping us recognize how extensive it is, but we cannot assume it is safe for women in the animal rights movement to come forward. And that's something we're working on, is how do we create safety in the movement, not just for the women to not be violated, but for women who've been violated to come forward and to get this to stop.
And what do you think will it take to get there?
So I want to talk about accountability within the movement, and we've got to talk about it sort of at three levels. There's the accountability of organizations. Organizations have to be held accountable for the behavior of their staff. Some organizations actually settle suits to protect the leaders of that organization. And so the silence that surrounds most of these settlements, the woman who was victimized can't talk about it, and she goes away. So we've got the silence, so it's perpetuated, the abuser isn't held accountable. And then we lose that woman from the movement. We don't even know how many women we've lost from the movement because they weren't believed, or they were believed and they had to settle a suit and leave, or however the organization handled it, it did not honor their experiences. So the organization has to hold abusers accountable and not settle suits to keep this quiet. They have to have a really good sexual harassment and exploitation policy, and they have to enforce it. I think looking at Tofurky's statement about who they'll fund in the future and the way donors can hold organizations accountable is really great.
Sorry, Carol, to interrupt, but that was in the blog posts you put up yesterday. Can you just briefly address that? Because I'm going to guess most people listening probably haven't seen that, and it does seem really germane to the conversation we're having at the moment.
So Tofurky is one of the groups, one of the donors that has created a statement that you can find at tofurky.com/discrimination. that says we support equality and security, and they're asking organizations to show them their formal written sexual harassment and gender discrimination policy, that it has to have mandatory reporting, that the complaints must be treated seriously, that whistleblowers should be protected, and have regular ongoing training. So having donors like that, I would like to see more donors. I'd like to see all big donors join into Tofurkies or create their own. I know that some donors have, and to create accountability to the organizations, for the organizations. But there's also accountability of the individual who's been found to be a sexual exploiter, a sexual harasser. And it's funny because I was having conversations with several leaders in the organization a few weeks ago, and they said, yes, but well, what's supposed to happen to X or Y or Z? You know, there was this great deal of empathy for the person who we knew had violated boundaries. And it reminded me of something I say in the Sexual Politics of Meat about how women become absent reference. Just like animals become absent reference in meat eating, they disappear, that in the animal rights movement, it's as though the women's experience, that they're the absent reference. Where's the empathy for the women who've experienced violation? In any case, the irony of asking that question, what about the abuser, is we exactly know what to do about abuse in the animal rights movement because we're always holding others accountable. There's lots of activism where we're holding an organization or a business or a corporation or a farm accountable, and we want them to change their ways. We don't want them to just say, oh, I'm sorry. We yeah. want them to change their ways, and that's what accountability is. And on my website, I, under CJA, go to blogs, and I do lay out what accountability for individuals looks like. And I'm drawing on my decades of work within the domestic violence movement, because what we know is that perpetrators will seek out allies to protect them from accountability. And when allies in the movement feel this empathy for the perpetrator, they're not going to hold that perpetrator accountable. But in an ideal world, accountability, well, first of all, in an ideal world, would have a feminist world where this wouldn't be happening because women would be seen as individuals and not objects for use by others. But in a world where accountability actually happens, it would involve the person taking responsibility for naming and telling the truth about what they did. Even when you look at some of these confessions, by the men in entertainment who've been called out recently, a lot of them have really failed at this. Yeah. They've manipulated how they talk. They've misrepresented. They've evaded.
Yeah. Well, one phrase I've grown to hate is "I now understand," and then whatever else is on either side of that phrase in their in their statement. Yeah.
And if they spend too much time talking about themselves, how they've experienced being held accountable, rather than talking about, I now understand that this was a terrible experience for the woman to whom I, unzipped my pants to, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So first is responsibility. Then you have to acknowledge that harm has been done and have empathy and acknowledge how the other person experienced the harm, not why you did it or why you didn't know that what you did was wrong, but how the person you harmed experienced it.
Yeah.
You have to accept responsibility, you have to stop the behavior, and you have to accept the consequences. And I think while there are some people who are saying, but isn't there a role for this person? There is no role in the animal rights movement for someone who does not accept accountability for their unethical behavior.
Yeah.
I think we have to have a bottom line. And I would say that's new. We haven't had that discussion in the animal rights movement.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see us push that forward.
Yeah. Let me let folks know that maybe you just be joining us. This is Talking Animals of Duncan Trust. Today's show is devoted to discussion focused on sexism, sexual harassment, misconduct in the animal welfare world. My guest is Carol J. Adams, a feminist, vegan, advocate, activist, and author of numerous books, including her landmark work, The Sexual Politics of Meat. We invite you to join the conversation. We're not taking calls at this point, but you're welcome to email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So in light of the things that are different and that kind of accountability that you're talking about, I'm curious if you think that with all the reports, the reporting, the revelations, etc., that we've experienced in the last couple months or thereabouts helps free that up. But relative to one thing that's moved back into the national discussion in recent days is that Trump admitted to sexually assaulting at least one woman, and there's more than a dozen women who've accused him of sexual misconduct. And of course, yesterday he all but endorsed Roy Moore. So I'm just wondering if that works against progress, perpetrators, you know, even thinking about being accountable, and or their victim survivors feeling more inclined to speak up.
Well, I think it certainly does. I think we have to remember two things about the Me Too campaign. The campaign that actually was started by an African-American woman 10 years ago, I believe, or several years ago, but really has now reappeared with that hashtag. Two things. One is, the more independent you are in terms of wealth or fame, the less vulnerable you are to the kind of repercussions that the average woman might experience. There's some protection. They can hire lawyers. They can face down some of the ways they're talked against. But if anybody wants to look at the kind of pressure even against the women who Harvey Weinstein came on to, offended, sexually exploited, sexually harassed, etc., read Ronan Farrow's account of the way lawyers went after anybody who was going to talk.
Yeah,
The pressure is huge.
Well, not only is the pressure huge, but it's clear from Ronan Farrow's latest piece that the agreements are so onerous that people can never really, unless they just decide to violate the agreement, can never really speak of anything that happened ever at any point. So again, you
got the silencing.
Yeah.
So I just want to say, I don't urge women to suddenly just all step forward and say, yes, this happened to me. If they're vulnerable within their workplace or within their peer group for doing that. Also, that we've got litigious. Harvey Weinstein isn't the only litigious sexual exploiter in the country. There are litigious sexual exploiters probably in the animal rights movement, or we know of some. So I would not say it's easier to come forward. I would say that there are some of us working to create a climate in which reporting can happen. And as Lisa referred to, the CAN had a website as a place to safely record your concerns. But on the other hand, and I want to just throw this out, Trump, there is a suspicion that there were some men who liked that Trump was that kind of person, that Trump views women as objects. And there's discussion of how, that it's both this racist patriarchy that's come back in thanks to Trump, that the racism and the sexism, the misogyny at the heart of the Trump administration resonates with some men.
Ugh.
And so it did not hurt him with a group of especially white men that he admitted to this last year.
Yeah. Well, again, that were multiple instances along the way of the campaign. You thought, well, this surely will do it. But this seemed to be in its own category, and yet it was just like all the others.
Look at the basic argument of the sexual politics of meat, that women and animals are interchangeable objects in a patriarchal world. And that's still true. Women remain objects. I mean, all of the images that people could look at on the part of my website that talks about the sexual politics of meat, the huge emphasis on women's object status continues. So it's the animal rights movement if it fails to adopt a feminist approach, fails to stop this object status of women. And the third thing that goes on here that I think we're always hesitant to realize, we think of really charismatic men, whether in the animal rights movement or outside the movement, and we think, oh, it's their charisma that makes them so important. What is their charisma? Kind of like O.J. Simpson's charisma, if people were around for that time right after his ex-wife was murdered. What if the charisma is related to the fact that they have women as objects in their lives? It's not like we should think, oh, these men are off doing really good things for animals. Oh, and by the way, they're sexual exploiters. What if their sexual exploitation of women makes them so confident and charismatic?
Okay, well, boy, lots more to ponder here. Just because we're in our final moments and I want to make sure we cover as much as we can. I can never cover everything, of course, in our allotted time. But let's say, Carol, someone's listening to our conversation now or later on an archive or whenever, who has been harassed, who is a victim survivor, and she hasn't done anything about it yet, in large part because of the very things we're talking about, and she doesn't really know what to do. Apart from saying, go to canhad.org, how would you guide her otherwise? What should she do?
Well, I would say do go to canhad.org. If she's in an organization, look at her personnel policy. And I would also say record what's happening in a separate dedicated journal. Don't put anything else in there except contemporaneous notes of what's going on. I think you need to know that it's not your fault. You're not alone. And there is help. CANHAD is one way. We are trying to develop some other resources, so CANHAD will probably carry those other resources. Check my blog, because I'll try to keep updating there. I would also like to say to the men in the movement, and you know who you are, it's time to change and hold each other accountable. And if you were doing that, we wouldn't have to be worrying about the victims.
And along those lines, this is a question that I posed to Dr. Kemmerer, but again, it just feels like maybe with everything that's gone on in all these other fields in the last couple months, let me ask you the same kind of question. Let's say the Washington Post or the New York Times did do an investigation on one or more of these problematic figures, the CEO types or the charismatic types, or would that turn the tide if people spoke to those reporters and the kind of investigations that we've seen prompt the kind of important revelations that it then has freed up women in the same kind of field and in other fields to finally feel like, okay, I can come forward. I can talk. Would that be a significant sea change kind of moment? Or?
Well, bringing anything out into the open is helpful, but I don't want any woman to think, oh, because that's happened, I can talk, without her knowing what her situation is.
Yeah.
There is vulnerability in coming forward, and I am not saying to every woman who's experienced something in the animal rights movement, step out today. I am not saying that, because the question of their safety and the safety of the movement hasn't yet claimed this as a problem, and whether something like from the Washington Post would do it, I would say what would do it? I would say if all donors held organizations responsible, that would start it. And if organizations stopped settling suits, and if board of directors of organizations knew and asked whether suits had been settled or if there's been any exposure, I would say that there's some top-down change that can come, and that it doesn't just have to come from the women who've already been made vulnerable because of the objectification and mistreatment and exploitation they've experienced.
All right. Well, that might be the point at which we need to leave it, because we have just about reached the end of our time. We've been speaking with Carol J. Adams. Again, the website for all these blog posts and tons of other resources is caroljadams.com. Carol, thank you very much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. And I think we all hopefully have learned a lot and can go off and find other information and resources and books and blog posts, et cetera, to learn even more.
Duncan, thank you for your great questions and for this program and for continuing to help us raise these issues.
All right. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Laura is up next with Radioactivity. Next week, November 29th, my guest will be Ronnie Graves, who has spent the better part of two decades creating custom prosthetic limbs for animals suffering from injuries, illnesses, and birth defects. Not just dogs and cats, but a broad array of animals from a duck in Florida to a baby elephant in South Africa. So please join us. And meanwhile, I want to wish you all a very happy and healthy Thanksgiving. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and Beyond Community Conscious Radio. Thanks for listening. Thanks again to Dr. Lisa Kemmerer and Carol J. Adams for joining us today for a really important talk. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. Rob Laurie is up next with Radioactivity. NPR News First with 5 minutes of news. Thanks.